Sounds like a mechanic's shop, right? It's actually an artist's studio in Wichita, Kansas. Randy Regeer's studio, to be specific. But Randy Regeer's work doesn't neatly fit into one category or the other. Neither does his life story. With his recent inclusion in a national art exhibit singling out the best under-recognized artists in America today, we thought now would be a great time to get to know Randy Regeer. It's my pleasure to welcome him to Central Standard for a portrait session. Hi, Randy.
Hi, thank you very much.
So you're just back from setting up one of your more elaborate installations at Crystal Bridges Museum in Bentonville, Arkansas. It was selected for the State of the Art exhibit, for which curators went on a cross-country road trip seeking out undiscovered talent, as it were. How has the experience of being quote-unquote discovered been for you?
Well, it's welcome, certainly, to be discovered. There is a sense... In sort of a practice like mine where you spend a lot of months of a year sort of solitary and working hard, wondering if you are on anyone's radar or not besides your friends and family, which is all very welcome. But you tend to lose sight of whether you're being if you're even evident, if you're presumed missing.
So it's so, like the tree in the forest, yeah. Did it make a sound?
So even though, I suppose a person could be discovered over and over again in their career. I've heard writers and an artist I heard a while back, a name escapes me at the moment, but he talked about how he gets discovered every few years.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's wonderful to be discovered, and I hope it happens again and again.
New Penny is the name of the work that's included in this exhibit. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, that's a work that I think I conceived of about 2004 was the time when I really it began to occur to me that was something I'd like to put in the world. It was 2010 before I was able to do so, and thanks to a Harry Faust grant in Maine and some other support, I finally was able to get that in motion. And it's this toy store that it references Twilight Zone episodes and a little bit of science fiction and this and that. And
so when you say it's this toy store, help our listeners out a little bit. It appears to be a quote unquote real toy store, and it is real in that it exists in the world. Yeah. It's physical, but the toys in it are your artistic creations. So are all of the other components that would make this appear to be a toy store, and it's not a functional toy store.
Well, it's a dysfunctional toy store, yeah, because frankly, they can be bought, and they have been. But it doesn't make it easy, right? It's not a good business model as standard business models proceed. They are, to sort of, couch my response, that I have a dear friend who once described my work. She said, "Randy, my biggest problem with your work is I can't decide if it's real or if it's true." And so, there's so many ways, if this were a court of law, that New Penny could be argued that it's a legitimate real toy store. And the opposing point of view would be, no, it's not, because it doesn't play by the rules it's supposed to play by.
What's the difference between real and true?
Well, I'm interested in that territory. And so there's not a specific answer to that, but that's the territory I find most fascinating. It's the landscape between. And so, it's a discrete object. It's this pretty robust building that's 8 feet tall and 6 feet wide, or 8 feet wide and 8 feet tall and 5 feet deep. And it's filled with like eight or nine of these very particular specific sculptures that reference vintage toys. Everything is rendered in photographic grayscale. That is one thing that sort of clues some people in that what they're approaching is somewhat, probably artistically conceived, or there's ulterior motives to it besides commerce. And yeah, the door's locked, so you can't get in. It's not operated by a human. There doesn't appear to be it looks like a vending machine now. And that didn't used to be the case. It's evolved each time I've shown it from I used to show it in vacant storefronts and buildings as a toy store. And it was locked up then as well.
Well, get back to the toys a little bit. What are the toys that are in there?
Well, each toy, first of all, though they very specifically reference vintage toys, I do not use toy parts in my work. So they are completely constructed of scientific ephemera and household appliance parts, vacuum cleaner pieces, agricultural parts, automobile parts, anything I can find that I can that has this sort of found object capacity to it, potential to be something else, right?
So the only found object you wouldn't use to create one of your sculptural toys is a toy.
I will not use toys. There are a couple exceptions early on in my career where I did, and I moved away from that quickly because that's just too blurry, and my practice is blurry enough without making it more so. So by insisting of myself, and that's a self-imposed mandate. It wasn't anything that anyone else imposed upon me, but it's also a challenge that I like. And there's a childhood reference to that that we can come to later if we need to. But it's that the idea that I could try to create things that seem very familiar, but that have not been seen before. And so by using these sort of found objects that aren't toys, the components of these so-called toys are very familiar to most people because, frankly, we've lived around this stuff our whole lives, most of us.
Your toys usually reference specific other time periods other than right now. Mm-hmm. Is that the case with New Penny as well?
Yes, it does, but it's not as specific as a fairly significant body of my work references very specific eras, you know, like the 1960s or a certain genre of toy in a certain era. New Penny's not that specific. It's more likely to reference sort of the sense of watching a Twilight Zone episode about a toy store than it is about a particular era per se.
But each toy is inspired by a poem, is that
yes,
right?
Yeah. Each toy is – and that's something that I felt I needed personally just to sort of see the pieces through. And that's – I don't suspect that's particularly evident to the onlookers. But, yeah, each toy in New Penny is references or is inspired by or has an allegiance to a poem, a song lyric, or literary work that I have found meaningful in my life. And that's really a personal thing. And that is – you know, that helps. Some of the toys are very specific to that, literal. Some, not at all. And I really don't assume or expect the casual viewer to sort of pick that up. But it's there if they look for it.
Can you pick one toy that's in this collection and tell us about the poem or the lyric that inspired it and describe it in a lot of detail so that people can really picture what you're talking about?
Yeah, there's a wonderful William Stafford poem. Well, there's a lot of wonderful William Stafford poems, possibly, maybe all of them, bit of a fan. Kansas-born poet who has moved to Oregon, and at any rate, a lot of listeners will certainly know William Stafford. One of his poems is called The Trip, and it sort of relates this childhood feeling of being in a vehicle moving across a landscape. And how the car is this machine, and the parents are sort of in control. And my interpretation, my personal feeling about that poem is it's that sense when you're, and my sense particularly being in the Midwest, driving across the Midwest late at night, and coming home from somewhere, and how you'd be falling asleep in the back of the car, and the dash lights were on, and your dad was in control, and everything was okay. And if you really played your cards right, you could pretend to be asleep still when you got home, so you got carried to bed and didn't have to brush your teeth. And that was like the perfect trip, right? And I don't get that anymore. Any rate, so that I'm adding a lot of personal interpretations to Stafford's poem. But that being said, there's a car and a trailer in New Penny that are made out of a – if you look closely, they're made out of a – the majority of the car and trailer are manufactured from an old – Modine gasoline ceiling heater that you'd see in these older buildings that I found scrapped. And I cut that in half, and so I had these sort of these two clamshells and proceeded to build this station wagon and camping trailer out of that, adding four human heads to the car. And then the car has the front axle is more like a steamroller axle, and it has a plow blade on the front, and the windshield is armored like a sort of a World War I tank. And all that to imply that this childhood notion that you are in a vehicle that could go anywhere and do anything because your parents are in control of it. And you're immortal and your parents are powerful and that's sense. And so that piece was a really deliberate effort to try to encapsulate all the things I feel about that poem.
That's really cool. I want to get back to so much. You've just talked about so many process things in the course of describing that have to do with your own knowledge of mechanics. And we'll get back to that. But one thing that I want to address about New Penny also is that it's been installed in vacant storefronts in small towns. And, you know, it seems like that's a really interesting decision. You've got these things that appear maybe at first glance to be shiny and new, fresh, you know, and they are. They're original creations, but they reference these other time periods. They're sort of these haunting toys of some past kind of discarded optimism, and that they're sitting in these discarded, these storefronts that are now vacant, which that's another form of sort of abandoned optimism. There's something kind of vibrant and mournful about all of this at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm a melancholy person, and, you know, the old adage, write what you know, right? And so, sorry, with toys, there's this, I didn't set out to choose toys as a medium. There was no intentionality. They just came to me as I began to create art. Toys were the first thing that fell from my hands and my mind, but the thing about toys is they reference so much of our lives. They're placeholders for so many memories, whether accurate or not. And invested in these things are our lifelong relationships and certainly our formative years. Well, I've been melancholy a long time, and I'm okay with that. I mean, it works for me. and I like a lot of art that deals with it. I love the writing of W.G. Sebald. I think it's beautifully mournful and poetic, and I'm really sorry he's gone. And so there has to be this sort of mournful aesthetic, which is in a, you know, one writing when I'm no, but also this sort of homage or this acknowledgement that that we're mortal and the world we don't, the most beautiful moments in our lives we don't get to keep, and there will probably be, hopefully be more. And there's this time that passes, and that's just the territory that I find most interesting, and I use toys to explore it.
Do you think that in some ways you're honoring that optimism by mourning it? Like, because in mourning there's a certain kind of longing, and that's a way of honoring the thing that you mourn. And this whole vacant storefront thing, it seems like built into that someone could read a commentary on changes in small town life, but it doesn't sound like that's exactly what you're doing.
Well, this is interesting. You're prodding me into a conversation I haven't got to have yet, and I really appreciate
it. I'm sorry
this.
To prod.
No, this is great. And I just, it'd be interesting a day from now to look back on what I'm going to say next and wonder, because it's sort of generating new thoughts here or new avenues to my own work. But addressing the issue of sort of mournfulness or lost optimism. I like that phrase, lost optimism. I've been reading a Heilbronner book, I think from the early 1960s, called The Future of History, I think. I just blanked on the title, but that's okay. But he wrote in the early 60s, you know, America is sort of specific in human history and as this nation that has just grown from a culture of optimism from the start. And he saw that he didn't think that was going to be sustainable, and we're living that now. This sense of this a lot of people are nostalgic or sentimental about what this culture of optimism that defined us for a century and a half or more. And so that territory is a lot of people are aware of, and people are addressing it in different ways, or not addressing it at all, or what have you. But there is something to be said about, like, when not to be macabre, to, you know, get too mournful or macabre, but like when you go to at my father's funeral a couple of years ago, how much beauty and community came together to celebrate his life, which is sort of a casual term it's okay term, but yeah, that's what we did, but how much that doesn't happen when he was living, that was not likely to happen. That would have been kind of awkward or, you know, he wouldn't have stood for it.
It would have felt like an omen.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, right. And so there's something that when a community of people, however large, sort of understand that something is lost, that was of value, there's a propensity maybe to just speak about, just care, maybe in a sense care more for it.
Or to understand it better.
Or seek to understand it. And I don't, you know, I don't consider myself a nostalgic person. I don't think the past was better. I don't think we can go back. I don't want to. But I don't think it should be discarded either. And I, you know, how do you carry forward? How do you steward what was beautiful or lovely about your past? And how do you capture it, hang on to it, and bring it forward with you, you know?
This is territory you've explored before. There's an installation I'm thinking of called Everything Must Go, which directly references a toy store that's teetering on the brink of closure. Can you talk about that piece a little bit?
Yeah, that was the very first show I had, and that was in 2003, and that was at the Beach Museum of Art at Kansas State University, and the curator, Bill North, gave me that show. I was rather naive at the time. I didn't realize what I was up to, and to his credit, he did. And he came to me and he said, look, you've been making all these toys, and he understood at the time, and I didn't, that I was thinking of them as these sort of distinct objects. But he saw that everything I was making was in conversation with each other piece. And he said, if you could do anything with these things in terms of a gallery show, what would it be in our museum gallery? And I said, oh, I'd just love to do this, you know, junky dime store that's faded. It's almost over. And to my complete surprise, he goes, okay, well, let's do that. And, you know, in retrospect, I was like, oh, my gosh, you know, who gets that, right? And so Everything Must Go was an effort to take all these, must have had 20, 25 pieces in it that I'd made, just one after another. Again, not thinking of them as in conversation with each other so much. And to put them all into one context where we quilted them all together into one thing. And so, and that's what that was. And I drove, I think it was 24 west of Manhattan and found an old grocery store that was out of business. And I bought the old vinyl flooring out of that. And, you know, so the room was very authentically filled with really kind of grody old retail stuff. And it was
glues and snacks was a section of the store.
Yeah. Well, you know, why wouldn't you want to have those together, right? I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I ate some glue in grade school. You know, that pace wasn't that bad.
Glues and snacks. Glue as snack.
Glue as snack, you know.
Randy Regeer, let's hold that thought until after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standards Portrait Session with artist Randy Regeer will continue shortly. Central Standard is back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and artist Randy Regeer, we were just talking about some of your work and getting into a lot of depth with the work itself, but I want to get more into your personal background. I want to get to know you a little bit better. So you've come to your career as an artist through what some might consider an unconventional path.
Some might. I don't. Although it's taken longer than, you know, it would have been nice to get here a bit sooner, but no, it's all worthwhile.
I think you're not alone in feeling that way.
Yeah, right. I really don't think I'm alone. And I grew up in a, I mean, I'm going to try to be concise, but I don't think I'll have much success with that. But here goes. You know, I grew up in an agricultural sort of industrial background in Oregon in the Willamette Valley. Didn't have access to much in the way of purchased goods. And didn't live near a store, so I wasn't one of the kids that could haunt a store, you know, after school. It was all rural and agrarian. So there was just always this desire, this thing that I would see in magazines or in the JCPenney catalogs and the toy pages, you know, where there was a world out there of objects. And I lived in a world of sort of dirt and chickens and tractors and, you know, And so I would have to visualize. There was an old combine that sat, an abandoned combine on the farm that my dad was a hired man on. And I would sit on that and try to create a sense of being on a spaceship. But, man, it was just the ugliest thing, you know. It took vast leaps of imagination and faith to conjure that thing as a spaceship. Has that served me? Apparently it has, because that – those years and years of desire and the requirement of using the imagination to conjure the world I wished I lived in did not go away, apparently. And so when I came to adulthood, to the point where I had the skill set that I lacked as a child.
To actually build things.
To build things. The child sort of came back and demanded, said, okay, you promised me this.
And when we heard the sounds of the studio at the very beginning of the show, it really did sound mechanical in there. And you do have some background in mechanics.
Yeah. I longed for the world of cars and speed. So that the most immediate access for that for me was the auto body industry. And my dad was a body man and painter as well. It was one of his avocations. So he was restoring cars on the farm we lived on. So he taught me the origins of that trade, that skill set. And then I moved on into the industry and had almost 15 years as a professional auto body painter and body man. And so I spent 15 years, and here's one thing where I want to make a clear sort of statement for the relationship of arts to industry is I spent 15 years immersed in the world of color and finishes. I mean, you walk into any production auto body shop that's worth its salt, which most of them are, frankly, because people care in there, these technicians. And these people are working with color every day and very nuanced color. And they're working on sculptures that are $20,000 to $80,000 cars, you know, more or less. This is serious stuff. And it's a lot of aesthetic and a lot of craft and a lot of integrity. And so that's a very organic and natural path towards what I do now.
That's something that is really interesting to me, especially living here in the Midwest with that. I don't know. The stereotype of the artist is not situated in the Midwest, period. Mm. I mean, if you look at the broader culture out there, the stereotype of the artist is in New York or Los Angeles or someplace like this. Here in the Midwest, we have all these different stereotypes, and that the industrial sort of the idea of the industrial worker and the artist, that these two things are distinct in many people's minds as well, as kind of a misnomer or misconception. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the skills that you developed in an auto body shop that serve you well as an artist?
Yes, but I'd also like to address the thing about stereotypes real quick, is those stereotypes go both ways. You know, it's not that as a sort of an agrarian industrial person, as my past was that that I felt the stereotype of the art world was somehow ruling me out. I gave them no thought. And I gave no thought to art. I did not have the conversation of art that would have invited me in at a younger age. So, you know, you can take a look at that from either side and see that people just aren't noticing what's happening just across the way.
Yeah, people doing similar things with no awareness of one another.
Right. So it's not something that's imposed upon, you know, the Midwest by the coast. Frankly, what do we care, really? What do you love to do? Do that thing and find your way with it. But back to your question, I think you were asking me about sort of the tangible assets of the trade. Is that what
Yeah, the skills that you cultivated as a mechanic that you still use today.
Yeah, well, if you're not a craftsperson, you're not going to make it as a technician in a body shop, because whether people use that term or not, if you have an automobile accident and you take it to a shop and you go to pick it up and you can tell that it was damaged, you're not happy. So what's happening is, let's just say you've got a $40,000 car and you hit a deer and you are angry and whatever, and it's costing you money. And so there's all this stress, and you take it to this shop full of people. You are asking them to turn back time and erase that incident. And how are they going to do that? They have to return that. They basically have to almost travel your object, your $40,000 object in time, back to before it ever saw that deer.
And they have to use their imagination.
And they have to use their,
that.
They have to, well, it, frankly, it doesn't require a lot of imagination, but it requires a lot of integrity. And it certainly requires an eye and a relationship of the hand to the eye. because it comes down to like 30 seconds of an inch, you know, and does the hood fit right? Does everything align? Is the color right or does it appear to be right? How do you undo this event? And, you know, these cars are built by billion-dollar industries, and then you're asking someone who's getting 12, 15 hour to make it just like that again. Well, there's pressure there. And I guess I didn't come here to labor for Autobody, man, and all things related, but I will stand firm on that, that in that industry, which is specific to my past, if you've got to do everything to the very best of your ability to convey when it comes back out of the shop that this thing, you know, this event didn't happen, or however you want to look at that, how that applies to me specifically is one of the things that some people, quite a number of people have sort of mentioned about my work is that it doesn't appear, they don't look like things that were made by an artist. They look like objects that have been in the world all these years. Well, that's very analogous. They look like I weren't there.
And that's the job of a craftsman.
That's the job of a craftsman who does repair work. Now you can get into custom cars and all those sorts of things, right? And that's another conversation. Same skill set, arguably more imagination involved. Well, not arguably, a lot more imagination. It's not that there isn't imagination in your trade shops. It's just not what you're being paid for.
Can you take me to the moment when you decided to take this leap and switch gears and think about art?
Hmm. Well, I don't think it was a moment, but it was a succession of – there was a pretty rapid succession there. And in terms of my – I mean, I'm 50, so if I say rapid, I'd say a couple of years, right? But I – back to the – and then this is probably the last thing I have to say about the body shop industry, but it was really bad for me, my health. It was – there's a lot of chemicals, a lot of stress, and I was unhappy. And so I was trying to get out. And what happened was in 1997, I was really wanting out badly, and I was in a very good shop and trying to extricate myself. And I, without going too into depth here, I had a vision, and the only thing about the vision was this sort of floating halo image of Kansas, the state of Kansas, and we were in Oregon at the time, had been for 27 years, and I asked my wife for permission to stop everything and move to Kansas and start over. And she said, yes. And that's when it began. We moved to Kansas in Abilene in 97, got a job at a furniture store. About 9 months later, all the solvents and stuff had really exited my system. And we decided I should go to college for the first time. So at 34 years old, I was a freshman at K-State, landed in a 3D design class with Rex Replogle. The very first thing I made looked like a toy just because I just fell out, and that was all over from there. I mean, I just like, really? I'm getting course credit to do this?
It clicked.
How can I do more of this? And they said, well, you could declare an art major. I'm like, well, okay.
Right. So you're a 34-year-old art major. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was like coming home to a place I'd never been before, you know, just wanted to explore every room. And a lot of that novelty has sort of worn off, but not the certainty.
About making art.
Right, right. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty in my life, but not the certainty that this is where my treasure lies. And I don't mean that in a financial way. I just mean this is my thing.
You've made a lot of references in this conversation to sort of back and forth in time, like that you've gone home to a place you've never been before, or the idea that cars, when you repair cars, you're taking them back in time and erasing an incident that never happened. In your art, you create these toys that are new in their concrete existence, but they reference another time period. Mm. And they reference a time of optimism when these things would have been new, but they're created in toy stores either you can't get into or that are made to look like they're closing. What do you think is going on there, the back and forth in time and where exactly am I located right now kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the aesthetic we can certainly attribute to sort of this broad term called mid-century, which is floating out there. And so from just an aesthetic formal standpoint, that's the era of design that really draws my eye, attracts my eye. I mean, sort of like it's a little bit like first loves. You know, you just don't tend to forget the first loves. And so so that era, those eras, that's the aesthetic that I'm drawn to. Now, it's not, but it's, like I said before, I don't feel like it's a past I can go back to. So I have to, I feel very compelled with that aesthetic to try to be certain or cognizant that the work has to have sort of contemporary relevance. It has to matter now in some respect. And so there's a tension there. How do you take something that appears to be 50 years old and how do you invest in it, a conversation that's relevant or current?
Can you give an example of a specific object that and how it resolves that tension?
Oh, boy. Well, there's a piece I made that maybe you and I have spoken about before. It's called Impending Future Bus, and it's at the Spencer Museum of Art at University of Kansas. They own that piece now.
In the interest of full disclosure, I did used to work there, and that's when I
became
familiar
okay,
with
that's
your work.
Right. Okay. It's all coming together for me now. And that was a piece that looks like it has all the aesthetic and appearance of a very oversized but sort of glorious toy bust. That's a vintage futuristic vision. It's got a glass or clear plastic top and all these passengers in it. And it looks like it would have been made maybe in the 1950s. And at any rate, I populated that entire bus with persons, probably 40 passengers. And everyone in the bus is painted sort of a brown or a referencing, you know, American black culture and that era. And then the very back seat of the bus, the second to last seat is empty. And the very last seat, there's a little white guy sitting there all by himself. And that was that bus began. I thought, man, I really want to make a bus because buses are just so cool. And it needs to be a glass top bus because how cool is that? But it's got to deal with now. And at the time I built that piece, there was an NPR segment on the changing demographic in America and how, you know, this was 2004, well before Obama and all that. And I thought, okay, this bus is going to be a bus from the past that's about the changing demographic and how is that going to feel? And then it really tied in strongly with the Ray Bradbury story, the other foot, which is as current as it's ever been.
Tell us about that story.
Well, the Ray Bradbury story, he tells, it's one of his, he's so many, you know, he's so many short stories. And this is one of them where he wrote it in the 1960s. Someone could verify that. Certainly was in the 1960s, if not earlier, about the African-American population of the United States just gets completely fed up. They build a spacecraft. They leave Earth, they find another planet, they populate it, everything's cool. Years pass, and a single white astronaut radios for help from space. They let him land, and he begs to, he says, we've done it. We've blown up the world. There's a few of us left. Can we come here? We'll do anything you want. You can, you know, we'll
seeking refuge.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll do anything. Just let us have refuge. And the conversation begins is the community, so it throws this community into turmoil, like, well, how do we let them come to us? Are they equals? Is it payback time? And it's a much more nuanced conversation than I'm qualified to give here. You know, urge to read the story, but it's a haunting story, and I wish it weren't still relevant, and it's totally relevant still, right? There's some conversations that, you know, they sort of have this, there are conversations that have this, we think of them as being sort of historical reference points. And they're totally still alive. They have
something about this you started with the idea that wouldn't a bus be cool, and then that you end up in this really complex societal ills kind of place. I've read an interview with you where you said that the toy was like a Trojan horse, and I think of that right now, and that a viewer could go through that same experience of, oh, cool, a bus, isn't that cool? And it's got this, whatever, it looks neat. And then before they know it, they're in this other world as well, that they've been, once they've accepted the gift on the surface, they have to look at everything else you've just presented there.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to look far to see what the the writing that's been done about Barbie in the last number of years, you know? Frankly, that should be applied to G.I. Joe, but I don't see much of that. I mean, it's these how are children prepared for adulthood with if you subtract all of the playthings that we provide our children with from the conversation, we're not talking about raising children in our culture. When you factor in the toys, if you take a hard look at these things, there is a lot of information there, and a lot of it is very discomforting. I'm not doing anything differently. I'm just doing it.
Different discomforting stuff.
It's just a hotter light. But I'm as troubled by a lot of casually commonly manufactured toys as I think my work could be troubling.
Well, something about that you, as a child, kind of longed for toys and longed for stores, and that you didn't live with ready access to bought goods like the ones that you create mm-hmm. or reference artistically now. Can you talk a little bit about that, your own childhood relationship with toys and bought goods?
Yeah, I can clarify. I did have manufactured toys. I didn't have many, but I had some that were very dear to me. What would happen was on Saturdays, my mother would go grocery shopping. So we had one day a week, and we would go into town. And town at that time was Silverton, Oregon, a little mill town at the time. And Oregon had a bottle bill, so I would gather cans and bottles during the week along the road and that people would throw out of their car windows. And I would cash those in, and I could go to the Goodwill in Silverton. And at that time, early 1970s, you know, you could get a toy for probably 49 cents, and I was buying toys from my father's generation. So I was getting Tonka trucks and toys and such that were built in the 1940s and early 50s. So they were worn, but they were robust. And those were the toys. Those were my first back to the sort of first loves. Somewhere, I think I still have a Polaroid photo I took of all my toys lined up outside our mobile home. And that's how much I cared about it. I lined them all up, and I would take a photograph of them with the camera. And so I did have bought toys in relationship to them, but they had a history before they got to me. They had stories. I mean, we haven't talked about stories yet, but you know, it's everything has a. People say, you know, everything has to have a story with you, and I said, well, everything does have a story.
Randy Regier, we're going to be right back to this conversation. We've just got a little time left for the rest of this portrait session. Central Standard will be back in a few. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. Today's conversation with artist Randy Regier is part of our portrait session series, in-depth interviews telling stories of personalities who make this an interesting place to live. The portrait session interviews are paired with photographs by Paul Andrews, and you'll see Paul's photo of Randy on our website later on. Hi again, Randy.
Hello.
Right before break, we were talking and you mentioned stories and the importance of stories. Can you pick up with that?
Yeah, I've been giving that a lot more thought. As I said earlier, when Bill North first really encouraged me to recognize what I was up to.
He's at the Beach Museum.
He was at the Beach Museum. Now he's the director of the Saline Arts Center in Saline, Kansas. And but really a person who is I give responsibility to for sort of grabbing me by the ears and look at your work and look at what you're doing. Don't you see? And what happened was, so with the beginning of that first show, that Everything Must Go, what I thought were these discrete art objects, and I said they became conversant with each other. What evolved from that was the recognition that what I'm really trying to do is tell stories, and I've always liked stories, and I still read voraciously, and I just love a good story, and that doesn't make me. There's nothing unique about that, right? But I want to be – it's very clear that I wish to be a storyteller. It's also clear that my vocabulary is toys or the appearance thereof. And so a lot of my – you know, some of the work that I've really – has become near and dear to me and is far less commercially viable than this discrete objects are bodies of work that desire to – tell this a narrative about something using toys to tell it. And yeah, that's really what's happening. How the career's moving at this point.
What do you think it is about toys that makes them useful in a vocabulary for telling stories?
Well, just a very pragmatic way, toys are good at capturing attention. And back to the sort of Trojan horse mentioned that you quoted, that you mentioned earlier, it's like people can profess to have no concern in toys and not to have any specific, you know, childhood memories of them. But I've seen people who, not even with my work, with just a vintage toy from their childhood, will just stop in their tracks and go, oh, I had that. And you know, like we do on the rare occasion where you might smell some older man in a mall, like happened to me a number of years ago, walked by that smelled like my maternal grandfather, like sawdust and Old Spice. A window just opened up that I didn't even know was there anymore. I remembered things that I thought were so long gone. And so a toy can be like a smell. It can open up a place that you thought was just, you didn't even know was gone. And I think they're powerful that way.
Even as kids, we tell ourselves stories when we're interacting with toys. Do you remember how you played with toys as a child? I mean, you mentioned lining them up sort of proudly.
Yeah, that was sort of celebrating this collection. But yeah, I did a lot of the work of play. And Johan Huizinga, the Dutch philosopher, wrote beautifully about play, and he says it's much better than I ever could. But a lot of the work of play is just setting this elaborate stage where you as a child have agency, and you're the puppet master, or this is the world in your scale, in your hands, and no one's telling you how things cannot be or can be in that moment. You are. And these toys are all... this is the world in that moment, and you get to be the storyteller, and you get to be the director and the writer and all that sort of stuff. And they're, you know, call them whatever you will, you know. But a lot of my play was solitary. Again, back to sort of the agrarian environment, there wasn't a large community. I had a couple friends, but they were miles away.
So much of what you're describing sounds just like being an artist. The world in your scale, it's all in your hands. Yeah. You're the director.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to lie, things haven't changed much. I just, I'm taller and older, I think.
You live and work in Wichita. How do you feel about the Wichita location as a place to be an artist?
Wichita is a very industrious place. And as such, there's a certain, and I've been fortunate to really have made acquaintances with a good number of the creative persons in Wichita, and persons who are completely advocates for the creative situation in Wichita. So across the board, and one thing, there's a number of things a person could speak for Wichita, but not the least of which is there's a real sense of accountability. Wichita is not a place to go as an artist where you're going to sort of just say, hey, I'm an artist, isn't that wonderful, and sort of just move about being fatigued for that. No, you better be making something. And there are a lot of people in Wichita who still make things or work in industries. And so if you're going to make something, you probably ought to make it well.
Because you have an audience that knows what it means to build something.
There's an audience that's not easily BS'd.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's good, and it's keeps you, because you need accountability as an artist. I mean, I shouldn't speak for others, but I'll take a rare step and say, and will. Accountability is important.
How do you, this is related to accountability to me, how do you structure your day and your time and your life as an artist? I mean, that's sort of an unfamiliar mode of a working day for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of tension in my practice because I have taught, and I really liked the company of students when I taught out in New England, and I missed that a lot. I missed the energy. I missed their questioning everything I had to say and testing me at every point and telling me about a new band that I wouldn't find otherwise. I missed that. So that's lacking. I don't, you know, I don't celebrate my own company that much. And so, but the flip side, you know, back to just sort of more tangibles, I just keep understanding that it's a very rare thing in 2014 to be, have the studio I have, whether it be in Wichita or anywhere, and to have a partner who just says, get out there and work, do you what you want to do, and I'll help you get, we'll get there. And again, it's back, just under, the key for me is basically just keeping my health together, making sure my relationships with others are in good enough shape that I'm not out there feeling remorse that I need to make amends with someone. That haunts me if that happens. And if I've got my mental slate clear and the people I'm close to were all right, I can make the hell out of work. but if something's not right, you know, with my relationships, no, that's crippling. And that can get at you when it's a solo environment because you think it's the only thing in the world. Then,
yeah,
right?
You don't have a distraction.
You don't have students or other distractions. Little things can get at you and haunt you all day long, and it can really curb the creative practice and take some of the, you know, the best out of it. So it's a dance, and it requires probably more discipline than I have. But I'm glad I'm older than – I'm glad I'm the age I am. I'm glad I'm not doing this at 25.
Because you think maybe you wouldn't have had any discipline?
I wouldn't have had the discipline that I have now. I would have been much more distracted by a lot of things. I'm really grateful to be where I'm at this age. I'm not – I don't have any regrets.
What's on your mind these days? Are there new questions you're hoping to explore or creative problems you're currently trying to solve or deeper into the ones you've already got?
I'm actually just really concerned about how I'm going to distill it's been a lot of, the recent press has been amazing. I mean, this is a great thing. The television thing, the CBS, the Crystal Bridges.
Yeah, you were on TV last night, right?
Yeah, yeah, or the night before, yeah. And then it's kind of this roller coaster, and then there'll be maybe another 9 months of silence in the studio. But it's how to distill all that into a livelihood. I have yet to really understand, and this is not, again, there's so many artists that can lean into the radio at this point. I have yet to understand how to distill this into a livelihood. I just don't. There's so many art models out there, commercial galleries and stuff, and they're just not working well.
So what is it that doesn't quite click? Like, is it – because it seems like you're having a significant amount of success. What is, like, that last piece that needs to come together for it to actually work? Where does it get stuck?
Well, it's quite one thing for people to go, I really love your work. And I get a lion's share of affection and admiration for my work. There are plenty of people that don't. Fine. It's just that, but people don't need to buy my work to engage it. They can just access it by, you know, engaging it at an institution or online, and have their experience with it. But they don't need to own it, and they're not. I sell very little, and on occasion something will sell, and we'll move forward with that. And frankly, I'm not about marketing, or I probably would sell more. I mean, I'd have to be two people.
That's such an interesting idea, because the person who makes the work is not necessarily a business person.
It just doesn't interest me, but it better start interesting me or find a way.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I'm so sorry that we've run out of time for today's conversation.
Well,
we could have gone on for 2 hours.
Hate to end on money, but there we are.
There we are. That's all the time we have for today's conversation with Wichita-based artist Randy Regeer, whose work now appears in the State of the Art exhibit at Crystal Bridges Museum. Thanks for sharing your morning, Randy.
Thank you so much.
Portrait sessions pair in-depth conversations with photographs by Paul Andrews. To see Paul's photograph of Randy Regeer or to listen to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Sign up for the podcast while you're there. You can follow Central Standard on Twitter for the latest news. Our handle is @KCURCST. Monday, in light of recent NFL scandals, domestic violence has been all over the news. We'll explore the nuanced complexities of that issue with psychologist Bruce Leese. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton, with lots of help from Matt Hodapp, Christina Leffring, and Patrick Quick. Our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs right here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend, everyone. Stick around for Up to Date next.